Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Its roots lie in the Chinese Civil War of the early decades of the 20th century, culminating in the political separation of the island of Taiwan from mainland China in 1949. The conflict between them continues today as both talk about reestablishing one China but fail to agree on how to implement it. In a moment, Talking History's Terry Clark will explore the history of the China-Taiwan conflict with Professor Caleb Clark. But before they join us, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. Jefferson Davis never admitted to either error or defeat. And that was the case this week in 1861, when his steadfast positions on states' rights and the expansion of slavery earned him the presidency of the Confederate States of America. After Davis's father died in 1824, he and his brother Joseph took over the family's Mississippi plantation, where, ironically, they were known as being comparatively liberal in their treatment of their slaves. In 1846, Davis served in the Mexican-American War, returned home a hero, and was elected to the United States Senate. As senator, Davis sought to counter the moves of the abolitionists in that legislative body, as well as to find common ground with his opponent in the best interests of the country. In the presidential election of 1860, he and most Southerners supported the Democratic candidate, John C. Breckinridge, who vowed to protect the South's right to own slaves. But when election results showed the Republican candidate, Abraham Lincoln, had won, Davis led the movement for Southern secession. On February 18, 1861, he was sworn in as the first and only chief executive of the Confederate States of America, a move he never regretted, even in defeat. Turning to history in the news, according to the Health Research Institute in Chicago, those severe abdominal pains that plagued the great composer Ludwig von Beethoven resulted from lead poisoning. While researchers at the Institute's Beethoven Research Project are unclear as to the source of such high doses of lead, some speculate that the poisoning may have resulted from the drinking water or the spa in which Beethoven bathed. This recent analysis was conducted by x-raying strands of Beethoven's hair. Upon his burial, the composer's head was nearly shorn clean by admirers who wished to take something home to remember him. Almost a decade after the Chinese government's violent dispersing of students in Tiananmen Square, Chinese officials are denying the authenticity of newly published documents that claim there was indecision, even great turmoil, among the nation's leaders as to how to deal with the million-person strong demonstration. Known as the Tiananmen Papers, the documents reportedly consist of minutes of high-level meetings and phone conversations that are dominated by the indecisive voice of Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping. Chinese officials deny the authenticity of the papers and insist that their publication is nothing more than an attempt by some to discredit Deng and conservative leaders and to bring about political reform. You're listening to Talking History. The conflict between mainland China, or the People's Republic of China, and the Republic of China on the island of Taiwan is more than half a century old. At one time, it nearly engulfed the entire world in nuclear war, and it remains unsettled today. Terry Clark joins us now with his guest, Caleb Clark, to look at the history of this conflict.
On occasion, the media report on a new round of tensions between the People's Republic of China and Taiwan, reminding us that there is a communist China and a non-communist China. Seldom, however, do we take the time to reflect on the relationship between the two, or for that matter, the U.S. involvement in that relationship. Here to offer us his perspective on the China-Taiwan relationship is Professor Cal Clark. Dr. Clark is an alumni professor of political science at Auburn University. He's the co-editor of the book, The ROC on the Threshold of the 21st Century. Welcome to our show, Professor Clark.
Well, thank you for having me, Terry.
Let's start with, I think, what should be the first question. If you could tell us, how was it that China came to be divided into both the Taiwan and the People's Republic of China?
Okay, Taiwan had been a Japanese colony that was returned to China after World War II. in the late 1940s, the communists under Mao Zedong fought and won a civil war on the Chinese mainland, but the government of what had been called the Republic of China under Chiang Kai-shek was able to evacuate to Taiwan, where it stayed under U.S. protection. Then arose dual regimes, both of them claiming to be the government of all of China, including Taiwan, while Chiang Kai-shek's had the advantage early. Over time, the People's Republic of China became almost universally recognized as the legitimate government of all China.
Now, a lot of this had to do with a civil war, as I understand, in 1948.
Yeah.
What occurred? What were the incidents involved here, and which party was the loser in this war?
Well, the Civil War really went back to before World War II, when the Communist and the Nationalist Party of Chiang Kai-shek both struggled to become the ruler of China against a whole group of warlords. The Nationalists for Kuomintang won, but they just continued their civil war after World War II, despite futile American attempts at mediation. And militarily, the Communists in the late 1940s basically totally wiped out the Nationalists on the battlefield. But while retreating from the north to the south, they were able to evacuate their leadership and some of their army about 100 miles to a large island called Taiwan.
You say that the Kuomintang initially had the advantage, but that the communist forces under Mao Zedong ultimately won. What were the major factors that caused the shift, if you will, in the balance of power between the two?
I'd say there were two major factors. One, the communists were better organized, more motivated, had better military strategy. Second, the nationalist or Kuomintang basically lost legitimacy during and after the war. There were a fairly corrupt regime. There was hyperinflation after the war. And in terms of what came to be called the hearts and souls of the people, it was clear that Mao's victory was widely welcomed throughout China.
Now, the Kuomintang, as you said, evacuated a good number of its supporters to Taiwan. What happened to those who remained on the mainland now that they came under the rule of Mao Zedong's forces?
Some of them were executed. Some of them went for political indoctrination. Some of them had made deals with the communists and joined the new regime.
About how many people would that include in those different categories?
Including people who weren't really Kuomintang. In the late 40s and early 50s, there were estimates of several million people being executed. For the other two, you know, off the top of my head, I really couldn't give you exact numbers.
Turning now the Kuomintang on those who actually left China then and they arrived in Taiwan, they must have had some sort of effect on the residents who were already on an island. How did the new arrivals and the island's residents get along with each other?
Most of the people living in Taiwan were ethnic Chinese. However, they've lived there a long time, and these so-called islanders didn't get along very well with many of the mainlanders who came. The Nationalist Party monopolized the top political positions, and many islanders felt that they were needlessly harassed and pushed around. Before the evacuation, there had been a horrendous conflict that thousands of people had been killed in between the Nationalist regime and the islanders. So there were significant tensions between the minority of Chiang Kai-shek's direct entourage and the overall population. Over time, though, I think that these tensions declined, and in particular, it was the islanders who came to dominate the very successful economy and got rich. And as gradually democratization or elections were introduced, it was islanders who came to dominate the Kuomintang party itself, since they were the ones who could primarily win at the polls.
So we were left with then, sometime after 1948 or in 1948, is essentially two Chinas. What's been the history between the two?
For about three decades, the 50s through the 70s, there was, you know, direct hostility. Every once in a while, one would shoot at the other. In the 1980s, when the PRC felt more secure, especially after the U.S. recognized it in 1979, there was sort of benign neglect. In the early 90s, after Taiwan allowed trade and investment between itself and the PRC, there was even movement toward perhaps friendly relations, but this broke down very dramatically in 1995 when Taiwan's president, Lee Teng-hui, was allowed to visit the United States, and China reacted very harshly, thinking this was the first step toward Taiwan declaring itself independent of China.
So there's been some concerns on the part of Taiwan that the People's Republic of China is trying to make some claim to it. Then.
Yes, that China claims that it is that Taiwan is simply a part of the People's Republic, even though they obviously can't enforce their rule there. And this brings us to the somewhat ambiguous question of what does one China mean? That's something that the U.S. has recently reiterated that it supports. You would think that one China means Taiwan is part of a country called China, but as I said, there's some ambiguity. For example, we sort of said that when we recognized China in 1979, but at the same time, we passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which said that at least until Taiwan voluntarily agrees to reunify with China, you know, supporting Taiwan as an autonomous actor is in the U.S. interest. And we continue to sell them, for example, large amounts of sophisticated military hardware to help deter Chinese attacks.
In terms of international law or the international community, which of these two countries is actually China, or are both of them recognized as China?
China, the People's Republic, is the one that is recognized by almost all major nations as the legitimate government of China, including Taiwan. There are less than 30 countries, none of them really major, mostly in Latin America and Africa, who recognize Taiwan or the Republic of China. And China has the lead and in most cases sole membership in most international organizations.
Was this the case in the 1950s as well, or has there been a change in terms of international recognition of which of these countries is actually China?
There's been a huge change. In the 1950s and at least early 1960s, most of the West recognized Taiwan, or Taipei, as the government of China. Now, since then, you know, there's been a tremendous switch in Beijing's favor, though many countries, like the United States, maintain various types of informal relations with Taiwan that you could call diplomatic relations, except that they're called something else.
What's the People's Republic of China's view of the world?
China sees itself as a rising power who is still denied the status of the great power that they feel they deserve. China felt that through most of the 19th and early 20th century, they were humiliated by various imperialists taking various pieces out of them. So unlike the 1980s, when China seemed to be looking to the West and the U.S. as a model of economic and political development, they now are significantly nationalistic and seem to feel that the U.S. in particular is trying to deny them their rightful place in the world. As a result, they see Taiwan as being a very central issue and as being rightfully part of China, and they won't gain what the Chinese call face until they get Taiwan back.
What about Taiwan's view of the world?
Well, here you get something that's obviously much different. Taiwan believes that it has been highly successful in economic development. It's now basically a first world country. It's, for example, third in the world in the in production of semiconductors, and in the 1990s it's had a highly successful democratization. Thus, they are somewhat indignant that 22 million people are denied the normal diplomatic status and membership of the United Nations, for example, that they feel they deserve. And so while the Chinese say, well, Taiwan is part of China, the people on Taiwan, at least since China started making major threats in 1995, are saying, these aren't our big brothers. These are imperialists who are denying us our face.
So there's obviously a difference in their view, and it brings them to the issue of the United States, since it's obviously, as you described it, been involved in all of this for quite some time. How likely is it that the United States could come into some sort of military conflict between these two antagonists here?
Well, this is a question on which there is a huge difference of opinion. I believe that the likelihood of a major war between Taiwan and China is not that probable, because while they both bluster and have found ways to irritate each other, they have the sense to pull back from the brink. Also, and this gets back to the tremendous amount of trade and investment, Taiwan has now $30 to $40 billion worth of investment in China, that while at the level of what's called high politics, there's a lot of tension, in terms of low politics or economics and social contact, there's actually growing economic integration and warm feelings. I have a former student, for example, who represents Taiwan at APEC meetings, and she says that she takes pictures with the Chinese representatives there. So I don't think the probability of a war is that great. However, if war breaks out, the U.S. might be involved, depending on the causes. If Taiwan was provoked it by specifically saying, we're an independent country, the probability that the U.S. would protect them is fairly small. If Chinese aggression started it, the probability is much higher, and the danger is, I think there are significant misperceptions on both the Chinese and the American side. The Chinese, in the past few years, have come to feel that America won't get involved in a war where there'll be American casualties. And so they think that, they can sink a few U.S. ships and deter U.S. involvement. The U.S. Navy, on the other hand, thinks that they can shut down any Chinese attack militarily within 24 hours. So, you know, those different perceptions are not necessarily the best situation.
Professor Clark, we've only got a few seconds, but perhaps you could just look in the crystal ball and tell us what's going to be the future of Taiwan. Is it going to return to being part of People's Republic of China as Hong Kong has?
In the long-term future, you know, in a generation or two, I don't know. The two sides in a generation could well come together. In the short term, at least as long as the political institutions in the PRC are what they are, I think Taiwan you know, really doesn't want to get involved with them in any way, and is smart enough to, you know, not provoke a military confrontation. I think that their democracy will stumble onwards with you know, political hassles like we have in the United States. Their economy will continue to be pretty good, and so you know, barring catastrophe, I think that the future for Taiwan is fairly bright. But then I'll add the caveat or asterisk that I'm probably on the optimistic side of scholars and diplomats on that question.
Professor Clark, thank you very much for being our guest today.
Well, thank you so much for asking me. I enjoyed it, and thanks again.
You have been listening to Professor Cal Clark, an alumni professor of political science at Auburn University.
Over 50 years have passed since the founding of what is commonly referred to as Communist China. And not only has its conflict with Taiwan continued unresolved, but unlike the Soviet Union, the Communists remain very much in power. There's been much speculation that recent economic reforms in China would lead to political reform. But is a free and democratic China even possible? Here to address that question is Arthur Waldron, Lauder Professor of International Relations at the University of Pennsylvania.
50 years have passed since Communist China came into being, and there is still no sign that communism is on the way out. The bloodshed at Tiananmen Square has never been acknowledged, and some say it is being forgotten. Cities like Shanghai are cleaner and more prosperous than anyone can remember. Chinese leaders are sought-after guests abroad. On their visits, they speak of many matters, but one thing they make absolutely clear is that they have no intention of altering the communist system of authority. On this point, they meet with little, if any, resistance from their hosts. A strong U.S. constituency, which believes that China is fundamentally on the right path, supports an accommodating approach to the People's Republic. They see every reason for the United States to resume its traditional approach to Asia, which for almost a century has placed China at the center as an economic and political partner and force for stability. The trouble is, however, that China will not be able to play the role it has been assigned unless its domestic situation is truly in order, which is very far from being the case. Consider the example of the USSR, about which we entertained similar hopes in the late 1980s, but which collapsed suddenly with a terrible thud. The problem lies in the communist understanding of history. Marx thought that society started out complex, but over time became simpler. Industrialization and urbanization created huge populations having common interests, which would, in effect, rule themselves once oppression was eliminated. That proved wrong. Modernization and change, of which there is plenty in China, creates not uniformity, but complexity. Governing such a society requires freedom of expression, free elections, and objective laws. It is not only moral preference, but practicality that has made advanced countries, without exception, democratic. For 50 years, China's population has been organized into units called Danwei, which provide work, housing, education, health care, and so forth. In a static society, such an arrangement could survive. But the unit, or Danwei, is not surviving the current economic development. What will replace it? Japan, Taiwan, India, and other leading Asian states have established functioning democracies which serve them well. The best choice for China and the world will be for Beijing to do the same.
You've been listening to Arthur Waldron, Lauder Professor of International Relations at the University of Pennsylvania. This is Talking History. For our site of the week, we call to your attention a new interactive website where you can experience the process of piecing together the life and world of an ordinary person in the past. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Using experimental interactive case studies, the website, dohistory.org, allows you to experience the process of piecing together the life and world of an ordinary person from the past. Currently at the site, visitors try to piece together the world of 18th century midwife and healer Martha Ballard. Her diary was the basis for the Pulitzer Prize-winning book and PBS film, A Midwife's Tale. Historians and teachers will find the site particularly useful for research projects. Included on the site is a searchable copy of Ballard's diary. The site helps you learn the skills and techniques to do history, and the often asked questions of what sources do we use and how do we interpret what we find, and much more, are explained. Launched by the Harvard Film Studies Center last year, the center hopes it inspires others to start their own projects to uncover hidden stories from the past.
Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, in the mid-18th century, a man traveling on horseback through the small shoreline community of Centerbrook, Connecticut, would be beckoned by a sign hanging outside the Bull's Inn. The simple silhouette image of a horse and the phrase, entertainment for man and horse, let him know that he and his horse could find rest and food there. The Bull's Inn sign is one of 25 such signs on display at the Connecticut Historical Society in an exhibit titled Lions and Eagles and Bulls, Early American Tavern and Inn Signs, which runs through April 29th. For further information, contact the Connecticut Historical Society in Hartford. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when, in honor of President's Day, we'll take a look at the first generation of the nation's leaders with award-winning historian Joseph Ellis. Until next week, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.